Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, episode 61, Fugitive Freedom, an interview with William Taylor. As you can probably guess by the title, today we're taking a break from our series on the conquest of Peru, so that I can bring you something special. Today's episode is an interview with William Taylor about his new book, Fugitive Freedom. In the field of colonial Mexican history, William is one of the most well-known and respected scholars. Over the course of a career starting in the 1960s, he's taught at the University of Colorado, the University of Virginia, Southern Methodist University, and the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of numerous books examining everything from indigenous resistance, Mexican colonial religion, to the relationship between landlords and peasants. He has won some of the highest awards in the field of Latin American history, both for his books and personally for his overall contribution to the subject. It's safe to say, then, that he has some interesting and authoritative things to say when it comes to Mexican history. His latest book, and the subject of this episode, is the story of two men who challenged the rules of colonial society. They were what were known as vagabundos, and by using deception, these two lived quite extraordinary lives, which not only make great, if at times sad, stories, but also provide us with a lens through which to learn more about both colonial Mexican society and a genre of fiction which was popular across the colonial era. So here he is. Enjoy. So I was wondering if you could start off by kind of explaining who the vagabundos were and how they emerged as a category of person.
Well, you know that it's hard to say who, and that's, to me, kind of an irony, because there's plenty of, there are reports, there are edicts, laws of other kinds that are issued during the colonial period from very early on, from the 1530s on. Royal authorities are worried about what they call vagabundos, or vagamundos, people who kind of aimlessly go about the world, and very concerned about these as a social and civic problem. Yet, we know very little about individuals called vagabundos, or even who they were as groups. Although in the 16th century, the earliest stages of this colonial history, most of the people that the authorities were worried about were Spanish immigrants who didn't seem to have a place in this in this new world, and were of concern as suspect individuals, people who might do bad things. As time goes on, you know, if we're looking for some kind of social description of vagabundos, more of them are identified as mestizos or castizos or mulatos, people who didn't fit neatly into the racial scheme that Spaniards had devised for establishing order in the new world.
And you mentioned the different racial categories and the elaborate scheme that the Spanish set up to kind of divide people into groups in their empire. I mean, the empire was so big, and some parts of it were so remote, and it had so many diverse people that I get the impression that administering it would have been quite challenging. And the way they tried to resolve this was by creating these categories. So would you say it's fair to say that because the Vagabundos were using deception to escape the confines of these categories, that they were seen as overly threatening by the authorities, perhaps more than their actual acts would suggest they should be?
I think that's definitely part of the story, but Vagabundos were not necessarily being kind of identified by race, either by authorities or perhaps by the Vagabundos themselves, although they wanted to pass as Spaniards if they could. The category of Spaniard was the desired category. But that whole question of racial categories is a fascinating and complex one, because in principle, this imperial system was idealized in terms of three racial groups: Spaniards, Indians, the indigenous people now called Indians in this colonial period, and Blacks, who were generally identified as slaves. But that kind of idealized three-part racial system is going to break down pretty quickly through miscegenation. And I don't mean just racial mixture, but cultural mixture as well. There are people who live in indigenous communities who have blue eyes. Are they Indians? Are they, who are they? Mestizos, Spaniards? So as time goes on in this long three centuries of colonial history, these categories, the three basic categories, kind of collapse. They break down, and increasingly the authorities have to find other kind of intermediate categories to label people and place them, to establish some kind of order, some kind of hierarchy in this society. And that's part of a larger story for me of Habsburg administrators in the 17th century, Spanish Habsburgs, called the Mixto Imperio. That is, they were interested in establishing an empire. That is, empire suggests order, established place for people. Mixto is a word that suggests jumbled. So we have this paradox of a jumbled empire from the point of view of authorities. They're worried about that. They want to impose order. But as the basic categories that they work from, whether they're racial or social in some other fashion, Christian, non-Christian, old Christian, new Christian, these categories begin to blur, and you either establish new categories or you find some way to either recognize those differences that are becoming more complex, or individuals, as you were suggesting, like people were calling vagabundos here, a category that's not one that they would accept. Most of the people who are called vagabundos, I don't believe, but they're looking for a way to bend the rules, to survive, to pass as something that that they probably aren't. That is, by the way they dress, they can appear to be someone they aren't. They can take on different personalities. In the case of the two individuals I talk about in this book, they pass or attempt to pass as priests for a while. One of them has other aliases, other ways of presenting himself, but both of them end up being imposters from the point of view of established authorities for pretending to be priests.
The two stories, the two people, characters you've built the book around, they both have really, really interesting stories. At first they seem quite similar, but actually in the book you kind of draw out how actually they're quite different in many ways, and their motivations are a bit different. You start with Aguayo, is the first one. And I personally think his story is kind of more exciting in many ways. I was just wondering if you could give an outline of what we know about his life.
Well, he's from Guanajuato, and he's born in the mid 18th century. This is a time when the city of Guanajuato, the mining district of Guanajuato, is beginning to experience a final big boom in the colonial period. Guanajuato, north of Mexico City, in the Bajio region, had been an important mining center since the 16th century. But it, you know, like most mining centers, it had had its ups and downs, but it's coming back again in the mid 18th century. That's his hometown. He's not a person of privilege. His father, to my surprise, the best I can figure, his father, who's illiterate and basically unskilled, became apparent when Joseph Aguayo was 14. Excuse me, the father was about 14 or 15 when Joseph Aguayo was born. So it's kind of off to a rough start there with a mother who apparently died soon after he was born. So he's raised in his early years by a father who's trying to make a living by gleaning bits of silver out of the ore that had already been processed by the big mines. And there was probably enough in the way of tailings for him to make a very modest living. But in any case, the father marries again. It's not clear exactly when, how old Joseph Aguayo was, his first son, was at the time. But in any case, the Joseph was, I don't want to say cast out exactly, but he clearly was not someone who was integrated into the new family that his father established. And he was sent off to a neighboring city, the city of Querétaro, to get a kind of rudimentary education, and sent to work on a ranch for a year or so. And he comes back to Guanajuato. His father brings him back. It's hard to tell how old he is. His story is one that's compressed in various ways. He's selective. He's a great dissimulator. That is, he's going to tell you what he wants you to know or what he has to own up to. The disarming part of his testimony and confession is that he owns up to quite a lot. So it's half believable, or maybe more than half believable. This is a guy who was good with words. His father brings him back to Guanajuato. He studies with a local Jesuit and serves as an acolyte in the church for a brief time, and then runs away from home. And repeatedly runs away from home and admits to the Inquisition when he's brought to trial that he had a mala inclinación. He was something of a juvenile delinquent and would run off by himself and be away for long periods of time. And eventually he gets arrested for theft. And it's possible that his father actually turned him in. He gets out of prison. Eventually, he's still a teenager. Gets out of prison and goes home and hopes that his asks his father if he would take him back or at least give him some clothing and food. And the father and his wife say, "No, this is it. You're out of here." And so from that point on, Aguayo is very much on his own, moving around in central and north central Mexico. How he's making a living at that point, how he's surviving, is not altogether clear. Although again, he admits that petty theft is something that he indulged in and had begun to establish these false identities as a royal official, in some cases, as an official of the mint or an assistant to a district governor. And eventually here, he's probably 18 or 19 at this point, he begins to pose as a priest. That seems a little unlikely since, men who trained for the priesthood wouldn't be ordained until they were 24 or 25. And he was a small man and looked young anyway, so that this was, in a sense, an imposture that was going to be a little difficult to pull off, but he began to pull it off. His experience as an acolyte, his study with the Jesuit in Guanajuato had given him exposure to the Mass and to confession and how to perform those duties, or how to simulate those duties. And he discovered that in small towns and villages that didn't see a priest often, if he was wearing the right clothes and could do the basic rituals, that he was welcome and he could make something of a living from that. I think he turned to that not because he really wanted to pretend to be a priest particularly, but because it was probably more lucrative than other ways of making a living that he had. So he eventually gets caught for that, and is sent to the Guanajuato municipal jail, which he hates, which is a dangerous place, and also an unsanitary place, not a place where you want to spend any length of time. And he's there for some months, and asks to be sent to the Inquisition, saying that he's got some spiritual problems to rectify, that he's acted like a heretic, and he wants to make good with the church and with God. So he eventually gets taken to Mexico City. On the other hand, on the way to Mexico City, he escapes. One of four times that he's escaped, he escapes. He's something of an escape artist as well as a smooth talker. He's on the run again for some months, and they capture him and send him to Mexico City to the Inquisition jail and court. And he makes a confession when he gets to the court of the Inquisition. The Inquisition is leery of him. In fact, he's given a whipping of 200 lashes on his way into Mexico City to give him a message that that this is serious business. And he undergoes a trial and confession. And the idea of pretending to be a priest is a very serious matter, because it's from church authorities, ecclesiastical authorities, because he's endangering, he's not only thumbing his nose at the church and the Inquisition in particular by doing so, but he's also endangering the immortal souls of anyone he may have confessed, who thought they had performed a full and legitimate confession, which of course they hadn't, because he wasn't an ordained priest. So he's given a trial, and he goes through an auto de fe, this procession of humiliation, and he is sentenced to 10 years of exile from any place that he pretended to be a priest. And it's not clear how many times he'd actually done it. He owns up to the ones that a church and civil officials knew about, but it's entirely possible he'd been doing this dozens of times, because he's pretty good at it. But in any case, 10 years exile from any place he'd performed these acts, and a sentence of 5 years of hard labor on the fortifications in Cuba, in Havana, Cuba. Here in the mid-18th century, Spain's got a big program of rebuilding fortifications to protect against European enemies. So he's sent off to Veracruz, the port of Veracruz, on the rope line of prisoners who were being sent with him. And he's put to work on the fortifications in Veracruz first, awaiting ship to be taken to Cuba. And he's there for some months. And again, he escapes. And that's another no-no. The court obviously doesn't going to look favorably on anyone who's not accepted their punishment and taken the bitter pill. But he escapes in Veracruz and again, at least once pretends to be a priest and finds his way back to his hometown of Guanajuato. He really never lives in Guanajuato again after he'd taken off as a teenager, but he keeps coming back, I think not to see relatives, not to seek help, but because it was a place he knew very well and was a potentially lucrative place to be. So he's arrested there and put again in the municipal jail, which he absolutely hates. And he wants to come before the Inquisition again. He knows it's not going to be easy, but he prefers that to the likelihood of something more serious by the way of punishment and endangerment in the royal jails. But his way of doing so at this point, the Inquisition is really not that interested in him at that point. But he, one of his jailmates is a hardened criminal who had been dabbling in witchcraft. And the two of them devise this plan to pretend, maybe it's pretense, maybe it's not, we don't know for sure, but to use witchcraft as a way of either escaping jail or presenting themselves as heretics again. They talk a lot about this to their jail mates. They put prints of the Virgin Mary in their shoes and walk around in them. They do damage to a statue of Christ. They take Rosa Maria, another name for marijuana, as a way of having visions that will kind of take them to communication with the devil. Or did they really do that? It's not clear. Were they doing that for effect? This is kind of a performance to get them back to the Inquisition. The Inquisition takes an interest in them, and it happens. The Inquisition says, bring those men here. And so Aguayo's again in Mexico City before the Inquisition, along with his erstwhile ally here, a man by the name of Agustin Solano. That's a long episode that leads to a trial of Solano and a second trial for Armand Aguayo. I won't elaborate on that beyond saying that the Inquisition is really more concerned about Aguayo than they are about Solano, even though Solano is the hardened criminal and is the one who, where there's documentary proof that he was engaged in witchcraft, had been engaged in witchcraft for a number of years. But they focus on Aguayo, and this time another 200 lashes, another auto de fe, and now he's sentenced to 8 years in Havana. And this time under heavy guard, he's taken back to Veracruz and quickly put on a ship for Havana. And he's gone from Mexico for a period of 14 years. And he's the one who tells us the story of Cuba. And again, he doesn't, it's interesting. He, as I said, a man of half truths, he owns up to a lot of bad things. Do you believe him altogether? Do you believe part of this? He's always very selective. He's not going to tell a full narrative. He'll kind of pick out a period of time when he knows the authorities know something about him and talk about that in some detail. But in Cuba, he says, well, you know, I was working on the fortifications in Havana for a little while, but then I got this position as a secretary to a ship's captain, a Spanish ship's captain who was patrolling the coast of Cuba. So again, he's putting his literacy to use and he's escaping the worst kind of punishment. That ship was attacked by an English corsair and set a fire, and Aguayo somehow survived and was taken to a hospital in a coastal town in Cuba. And from there escapes again after he recovers in part. We don't know what happens to him after he escapes. He won't tell us much, except he says he gets arrested. He's found and arrested for, he says, for theft. And he's sentenced to 10 years on fortifications in the port of Santiago of Cuba. He says that he takes on an alias at that point. Jose Montero is the alias. And he says he does that because he hadn't served his full 8 years for the original sentence. And if he told the authorities what his real name was, he'd be sentenced to the remainder of that term plus whatever they wanted to add to it. So he adopted this alias, or he says he does. So he serves out, he apparently served out his term in Santiago and is floating around Cuba for another 2 or 3 years before he takes ship back to, ship back to Mexico. His release papers after he left the fortifications at Santiago are in the name of Jose Montero. And that's why he makes a point of saying, well, this is an alias I adopted, because he has to show those papers in Mexico when he returns. And he, when he comes back to Mexico in the late 1780s, he shows his papers. As it turns out, he goes to Guanajuato, back to Guanajuato, and the Inquisition delegate, representative at that point, the comisario, had been the same one who had been there 14 years before and knew who Aguayo was, saw him on the street and said, "Who is this guy? He's looking suspicious again. Let's see his papers." And the papers to the comisario looked a little suspicious because it wasn't in his name, wasn't in Aguayo's name, it was named Montero, and the printing on the paper looked a little strange. So he informs, the comisario informs the Inquisition, said, what should I do about this guy? And the Inquisition says, at that point, let's have another little investigation. You hold on to him, observe him, see what he does. So he's under, in effect, a kind of house arrest for, I don't know, a period of about 8 months. And eventually the Inquisition decides that, it's okay to let this guy go. He's come back. He's kind of ill. He's now much older. He's in his 40s now. He's lived longer than he should have, really, by all rights. Let's let him, he'll perform some spiritual exercises and then he can go where he wants to go. And he asks to go to another mining camp in northern Mexico. And the authorities in Guanajuato and the Inquisition are happy to have him go. And so he disappears and presumably goes north, but reappears 2 years later in Guanajuato first and then in Mexico City. And he's arrested again for posing as a priest. This is a man in his mid-40s now. He's obviously unreconstructed, and he's arrested by authorities of the Archbishop in Mexico City at that point for this this heresy. And the Archbishop's court sends a message to the Inquisition saying, "Well, we've got this guy. We know you've seen him before. What should we do with him? Can we pass him along to you again?" And at that point, the Inquisition throws up its hands and said, "No, we've had enough. He's in your jurisdiction now." And that's kind of the end of the story. But the character who emerges, for me, the fascinating part of dealing with these two characters, not only are vagabundos as individuals basically unknown in this history of colonial Mexico, but there's a chance to get a little bit through their actions, through their words, through testimony about them, get into their inner lives a little bit. And that was part of the appeal, both with Aguayo and Atondo, my other picaresque-like, vagabond-like character.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating, because Aguayo, he's a survivor, clearly. And you can argue that he had little choice because of the circumstances of his upbringing. But he's very calculating. He knows what he's doing and he knows exactly how much he can get away with. Sometimes he pushes it a little bit too far.
Right. He's an extraordinary performer, I think.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned Atondo, the second character, who my impression of him was a bit different. I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about him and what we know about his life.
Sure. The reason why I paired the two of them together was that, number one, I thought I had some rich material about these two characters that I don't have about other people that either got labeled vagabundos or that we would think of as kind of picaresque characters. He bears some similarities to Aguayo in being somebody who's as a young man he's out on his own. He's also born poor, but not as poor as Aguayo, and he's got a better claim on being of Spanish descent. Aguayo, according to his own self-presentation, is descended from old Christian Spaniards, but the witnesses who met him describe him quite differently. They call him usually an indito, a little Indian. This is part of his, I think part of his mystique is that he seems insignificant in various ways. Looks are deceiving in the case of Aguayo. Atondo has a better claim on being of Spanish descent and of having kind of an old Christian background. One of his uncles had become a priest, and they're from Mexico City. His mother was widowed. It was certainly not wealthy, but did what she could to provide him with an early education. And he made several false starts at becoming a member of a branch of the Franciscans, a quite strict branch of the Franciscans that his uncle had become a member of, but he's similar to Aguayo in the sense that he becomes something of a young delinquent, disowned by his family, without steadfast friends or community ties, and he also has to live on deception and broken promises. But he's a very different kind of character, I think. He's much less of an effective performer. He's not as good with words. He's not as calculating. His motivations are muddied in various ways. But he has what he calls a propensión religiosa, this religious propensity. And it's going to be reflected in twice trying to become a member of this monastic order, and in both cases resigning. He says for health reasons. Hard to tell exactly what's going on at that point. He eventually becomes a donado, that is a servant in a Franciscan college convent in the city of Orizaba on the way to Veracruz. How he ends up there is a story of his kind of picaresque doings, because I don't want to say love affair exactly, but he had something of an affair with a young woman in Mexico City after he left the Franciscan convent there initially and had been apprenticed as a tailor, something he clearly didn't like, but he acquired the skills of a tailor. He had this girlfriend, and she is pregnant, and she tells Atondo's mother that Atondo is the father. Now, Atondo denies that. He says he never had sex with her. But his mother says, you either marry this woman or you join the army and go to China, which meant going to the Philippines. Well, Atondo is faced with, he's in between a rock and a hard place at that point. He doesn't want to marry the woman and doesn't. So he joins a military unit, but a unit that's in the city of Puebla rather than going off to China. So he, and at that point, his mother basically disowns him, and the relatives in Mexico disown him. And he's there for a while, and his propensión religiosa comes out. He says, and he convinces his captain of this military unit that he has a vocation as a religious person, and his unit gets moved off to Orizaba, and there he flees. He deserts his military unit and goes into the convent the college convent of the Franciscans. And at that point, he claims that he's a heretic. What he wants to do is have the Franciscans take him into custody and hold him there so he doesn't have to go back to his military unit. That doesn't quite work out. The Franciscans discover that he's not a heretic, but they contact friends in Mexico City to find that out. So they return him to his military barracks, and he undergoes a kind of humiliation that's Christ-like, taunted by his fellow soldiers and all. And eventually the Franciscans in Orizaba allow him to come back as a donado, as a servant. And his military unit is compensated. The Franciscans pay for the recruitment of someone to take Atondo's place. And he's there for a couple of years, he says. And then suddenly, you know, kind of out of the blue, he leaves. After again establishing a kind of love relationship with a young woman and exchanges gifts, and the things he gave her apparently were stolen from the convent. She gives him sweetmeats and little treats and whatnot. But suddenly, you know, he leaves there. He doesn't go looking for his girlfriend at that point at all. He borrows a horse under false pretenses and trots off to Mexico City, back to Mexico City. And there he, in very short order, courts a young woman, marries her, has a child, a daughter by her, abandons her almost immediately, serves again as an apprentice tailor. Again, this looks kind of like a whirlwind of picaresque leavings and departures and betrayals and deceit. And eventually, you know, there's a long story here. But eventually, he says that he goes to Puebla and he has a kind of epiphany and he's recovered his propensión religiosa and asks the Bishop of Puebla to allow him to return to the convent in Orizaba. And on his way back there, he says he's captured by insurgents. This is during the Mexican War of Independence. Now, this part of his life. He's born in about 1781. His whole presentation of self is kind of strange. He never tells us exactly when things happened by year, but he can tell you the exact month and often the exact day. But in any case, about 1813, he's on the way back to Orizaba. He's captured by insurgents who are loyal to José María Morelos, one of the great regional leaders of the independence movement. And he says these people abuse him, and they send him off to Morelos's headquarters in Chilpancingo, Guerrero, and they decide that he's a royalist, he's a supporter of the crown, he's loyal to the old regime, and they send him off to a presidio, an insurgent presidio, to serve hard labor. And eventually he's released, he says, and he wanders around and eventually is taken up as a donado by under the Franciscan convent, a larger one, the great Franciscan convent at Querétaro. And he says, they send him out. You know, he serves there again for perhaps a year or more. Yeah, so he's not as restless as Aguayo is. He's more driven kind of by circumstance in his travels. He seems willing to settle down at least for a while, and then suddenly, you know, something happens and he's off again. Well, they send him out on an alms collecting tour in an area where there are insurgents. He's worried about that. He's captured again. He begins to present himself as a priest at that point, not just as a donado, even though his papers say at the top of the page of kind of license to collect alms, it says laico, that is, he's a layman. This is a layman's task. He scratches that out and puts in a clerical appointment. So he's presenting himself as a priest at that point. In retrospect, he's not at that point admitting that he was saying mass or performing confessions, but he says he gets taken captive again by insurgents, and they move him around again. He travels fairly long distances in central and north central Mexico here as a captive. So all of his movement is not, you know, kind of from one parish to another doing his impersonation, but He says he's released from that captivity, because he says he makes a persuasive argument that he'll never be an insurgent. He stands up to these insurgents and says, I'm a loyal supporter of the crown, of the church, and all the rest. And he says they release him because to keep him around, well, that was gonna subvert their people. That's a little hard to believe, but nevertheless. At that point, he's back in the area that he'd been collecting alms, and now posing as a priest and clearly performing mass and, above all, confessing individuals in small rural communities, basically. So he goes about that in a kind of manic way for a while, and eventually some of the parish priests in this area meet him and decide that he's a phony and he's untrustworthy, and they report him, and he eventually at that point goes to the Inquisition and is there an unusually long time. There really weren't prison sentences at this time in the 18th century, whether it's the royal courts or the ecclesiastical courts, but you could be held for several years pending a trial and verdict. And in the case of Atondo, he's held for about 3 years, and it's looking like an informal prison sentence. They want to keep him on ice because he's a risky character, not because he's devious, but because he has this kind of almost mystical sense of mission that he's very reluctant to admit that he had never been admitted to study for ordination, that he'd only been a donado, he'd only been a servant, partly because his own self-identity is wrapped up in this idea of his religious propension. But he's there for about 3 years, and during that time, he confesses. The inquisitors decide it's not an adequate confession. He really is not telling everything he knows, and so he's kept there. And eventually, over the period of about 12 months, he writes out his own confession, which is very unusual, extremely rare, and it's really a very long confession, 30 pages long. It really is the key document for trying to make sense of who he is and what he's about.
And so in the book, you use a genre of fiction, the Picaro genre, to examine the lives of Aguayo and Atondo. What was this, and what is this genre, and how much can it tell us about their lives and about the vagabundos more generally?
Okay. The word picaro, with its analog picardia, that was a term that came into popular use in the 16th century. Picaro evidently was being used by about 1530, according to Spanish linguists, and it was a totally negative term at that point when it was beginning to circulate in speech. It was closely related to vagabond, to vagabundo, a suspicious character, someone who couldn't be trusted, someone who didn't do the expected thing, didn't obey the rules. Nothing very attractive about the picaro as the term was being used at that point. It comes into use, I think, because of the great changes that are happening in the 16th century. That this is, you know, we think about Renaissance, you know, we think about a golden age, we think about Spain and its possessions overseas and expansion and innovation in things like the printing press, movable type, new technologies for navigation that allowed long distance travel out at sea, lots of things going on that seem kind of creative. But this is also a time of enormous turbulence, of great disruption, displacement. So it's a time of opportunity and a very dangerous time. Dangerous in another sense, that people are being they're being, in a sense, cast out of their communities. Up to the 15th century, most people were living a rural agricultural life. There hadn't been much in the way of great urbanization yet. That happens in the 16th century, and looking at Spain as well as other parts of Europe. It leads to lots of people who move, people on the move. This is kind of an age of strangers that begins in the 16th century and in some ways continues right up to our own time, with, you know, periods of kind of accelerated change in which people move around, or you come in contact with people who are different from yourself. There's a kind of uncertainty about this, that people are going to have to make their living in a new way. They're going to have to move into a town or city. They might be conscripted into one of the European wars of the 16th century, which are continuous for Spain. You're going to move perhaps with rising expectations to the new world. This is a place where you can maybe strike it rich. Hacer America, as the Italians said in Argentina in the 19th century. They come to America to make America, to make their living here, to strike it rich. So for lots of reasons, people are moving around, and or forced to move around usually. And so we have a lot of people who, in a sense, are who are caricatured by this new literary figure that emerges in the mid 16th century, the picaro. Picaresque novels begin to show up. And the first one is Spanish, and it's Lazarillo de Tormes in the 1550s. And then around in the 1590s and early 17th century, we've got a spate of picaresque novels. One of them is extremely important, called Guzman de Alfarache, which was at the time as popular as Don Quixote was, evidently, a bestseller of its time. And it spawned another kind of generation, several generations of these picaresque novels. And the protagonist is always an anti-hero, is one of these outcasts, one of these vagabond kind of figures, who moves around, who lives on deceit, who tricks people, who steals from them, isn't violent generally. That we're not talking about violent crime or figures who, who look like hardened criminals. They may be juvenile delinquents. They may be kind of professional pickpockets among them. But these are people who are surviving by their wits. They're outsiders. They're from elsewhere. They're under suspicion just by their nature. We don't know who this person is. And those and these are loners generally. They don't have close friends. They don't have family. They're surviving by their wits. These anti-heroes are not totally negative. So they're not exactly like the Picaro of popular usage in 1530s and 1540s. They have their attractions. They're sort of interesting, amusing, witty, cunning. So you begin to see how the term Picaro is changing after these novels become come into currency. The dictionaries of the 18th century, the early 18th century dictionaries in Spain, have a kind of split personality about what Picaro means. It means, on the one hand, all these terrible things, period, but it also means these kind of pleasant, amusing, cunning, untrustworthy, but scoundrel-like characters at the same time. To me, Aguayo looks like one of those scoundrels, and my guess is he thought of himself in those terms. The Guzmán de Alfarache picaresque novel circulated in America quite widely, and the term Picaro and it's in this kind of complex meaning, this kind of Jekyll and Hyde meaning was current in Spanish America in the 17th and 18th centuries. So whether or not he ever read those novels, which is unlikely, I think, he was literate, but he wasn't someone who had kind of the time or, kind of stayed in any one place long enough to be sitting down to read reading Guzmán de Alfarache, which runs to two big volumes. This is a kind of literature that comes out of the time, it comes out of this time of disruption and disorder, a character that replaces the romances of chivalry, chivalric hero of the early 16th century that Spaniards were consuming as their popular literature. It comes to rival and then displace that kind of literature. So I think the picaresque novels are interesting and important, partly as a reflection of those times. That in fact I turned to the best Mexican example we have from this period, Periquillo Sarniento, as my kind of way of beginning to understand Picaros long ago when I was curious about vagabonds and people kind of out of place, people looking for a home in early colonial history. That was an interest of mine, but I really couldn't pursue it through historical records. I couldn't find those people in the way that I'd hoped to. So the Periquillo Sarniento was something of a touchstone for me about who these people were, which is not to say I was going to say that they're just... the Periquillo is just like any particular individual. It becomes a kind of yardstick against which to understand an individual who in some ways looks very much like a picaresque, I don't want to say rebel either, because these Picaros don't have a social mission. They're not revolutionaries. They're not insurrectionists. They're out there doing their own thing, surviving by their wits as best they can.
I'm really glad that you found these stories and brought them to our attention, because they're so interesting for what they tell us about society at that time. But also they're just really great stories, I think. They're so eventful. But I think if you hadn't, they would have remained completely unknown. So how did you find these stories, and how did you approach the research in writing the book more generally?
This book is unexpected, shall we say. I'm 12 years retired from my professional life as a college professor. So I'm in my 70s now. This is not a new subject for me. It's a subject I was interested in 50 years ago. One of the first books I purchased in Mexico was a book called Los Vagabundos en la Nueva España, Siglo XVI, Vagabonds in New Spain, 16th century. And I bought that and I wanted to know more about strangers in this history, this whole idea of how do you kind of make a place for yourself, identity, survival, ways in which this colonial system seemed to be both coming together, growing, being established, and also falling apart at the same time. That was a thought I had in the 1960s when I started my work. And so I thought, well, this is great. I've got this book and I've read the book, except the book is really only, using these administrative records, these orders, these laws, these kind of little letters by viceroys saying, this is a serious problem we have here with these vagabundos. They're out there and they're making trouble. They're stirring things up. They're creating disorder. Well, that wasn't helping me understand who they were. So I went to the Mexican National Archive, which is the great repository of criminal records and other kinds of court records, ecclesiastical courts as well. The Inquisition records end up mostly in the National Archive. Some of Mexican Inquisition records are dispersed in collections throughout the world. But I couldn't find these characters. I couldn't find them there. And so I sort of left that subject aside and moved on to other things that I could kind of get my teeth into and make what I'd hoped was a lasting contribution to understanding the kind of how this society, how this political and economic system worked. Along the way, I gathered microfilms for other things that seemed interesting as I was doing my research on parish priests and peasant villages and religious life. And about 4 years ago, I kind of in a fit of downsizing, I decided to go through my papers and microfilm and throw things out and pass things along to colleagues who I thought might be able to use them, just kind of miscellaneous things that I thought might be interesting at some future time, 30 years ago, and I'd ordered some microfilm, that sort of thing, taken some notes. And I was looking through my Inquisition microfilms because several colleagues of mine are doing transcriptions and translations of Inquisition cases for classroom use. And I thought I might have something that would be useful to one or another of them. And discovered that I had a big chunk of this really voluminous record for Joseph Aguayo. I had part of one of his Inquisition trials, a good part of one of his Inquisition trials. And I started reading it and it clicked. I said, boy, this is exactly what I had hoped to find 50 years ago. And somewhere along the line, I'd taken a glance at the case file in the National Archive in Mexico City and ordered microfilm of it, but had never looked at it with any care. So I started reading it carefully, and the deeper I got, the more interesting it became to me, and I started looking for other records about him and discovered there was yet more, these two other encounters that he had with the Inquisition. So you end up with hundreds, over 600 pages of record for this one individual. And they turn out to be really wonderfully rich records, not just kind of formal proceedings, but lots of interesting testimony and his own words and lots of documented actions of things that he did and his selective representation of himself the half-truths that he could tell, he could spin out with such fluency. So I had Aguayo, and I started thinking, is there anyone else that I could pair with him as a way of, not saying that these two individuals are basically the same, but a way of understanding their individual lives, putting them together as a way of seeing how different they were, as well as their similarities, and trying to understand both the similarities and the differences. And I taught at the University of California at Berkeley for the last 10 years of my career, and had done extensive work in the Bancroft Library going back 30 or 40 years. And they have a wonderful collection of Mexican manuscripts and rare books. And I had glanced at a case file, the Atondo case file, at the time, looking for things that students might be interested in reading and writing about. And it looked sort of interesting, but I hadn't paid close attention, didn't look closely. And here in these last 2 years, after I'd found the Aguayo materials and then had discovered yet more materials in Mexico City that I could integrate with those, a good friend of mine who was the curator of Latin Americana in the Bancroft Library reminded me of the Atondo file, which I had just briefly seen. And I went back to it and read it carefully and thought, this is a really interesting case to pair with Aguayo, because in some ways they look rather similar in their picaresque lives, the picaresque side of their lives, but that Atondo was a very different kind of character than Aguayo. And so putting those together allowed me to think about both the relationship to kind of what Pícaro could mean at this time, also recognizing the substantial differences between them.
I'm glad you found them. So, thank you very much. So the book's called Fugitive Freedom, The Improbable Lives of Two Impostors in Late Colonial Mexico. And am I right in saying it's out later this month?
That's correct, Max, yes.
Excellent. Well, thank you for coming on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by Max Sargent. For more information, visit the website www.maxsargent.com/thehistoryoflatinamerica. And that's spelt MaxSergeant. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to get in contact at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com. You can also find the Facebook page by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. The Twitter handle is @historylatinam. And if you've liked the show, you can help out by leaving a review on iTunes. Alternatively, if you visit the website, you'll see that each episode is accompanied by relevant photos. Most of these are my own, taken during my time in Latin America. All these photos and more are available to purchase as prints at my Etsy shop. You can find this at www.etsy.com/maxsargentphoto. That's spelt www.etsy.com/maxsergeant photo. Thanks for listening.